How can two homes with similar attributes and similar neighborhoods be so different in value? Race can play a part in that. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. A new study from the Brookings Institute shows that homes in majority black communities are on average tens of thousands of dollars less than similar homes in majority white neighborhoods. That's hurting black homeowners, and it could mean millions less for local governments. We'll talk about the study. Also, Hamilton is playing in South Florida, and that's launched a larger conversation about rap and hip-hop. We're joined today by a panel of artists who are going to discuss the history of rap in Miami. And sometimes it's difficult talking about life with an illness or disability. A Miami Beach man is trying to help us have these conversations, and he's doing it through jazz music. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN as we kick off this 2019. Hope you had a wonderful holiday and a great new year. Bear with me. I did not because I got sick, and so I'm gonna punch my way through this show today. So deal with my raspiness, but let's get started. Again, looking forward to 2019. A new report from the Brookings Institute has shocking findings for people that own homes in majority black communities. On average, the report finds that a home in a majority black community with similar characteristics and amenities to a home in a majority white neighborhood is $48,000 less in value. Now, the researchers looked at many of the factors that we consider when home buying: the number of rooms, crime rates in the neighborhood, walkability, and so much more. And they narrow the data down to metro regions, and South Florida's majority black communities are experiencing similar devaluation to the national experience. Now, this has a major impact on black homeowners. The researchers estimate a cumulative loss of $156 billion. And the reasons for the major cost difference: a history of racist housing policies and stereotypes about black neighborhoods. Andre M. Perry is the David M. Rubenstein Fellow at Brookings, and he is the lead author of this report, and he joins us now. Mr. Perry, thanks so much for the time.
Yes, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. You know, looking at this study, I mean, basically saying that homes in predominantly black communities are valued less than those comparable in white neighborhoods, I mean, is the study basically saying that those homes are less because of racism?
Yes, it does. We were very careful to, and when I say we, Jonathan Rothwell of Gallup and David Harshbarger, also of Brookings, we were very careful to control for those variables that people consider when buying a home. They want to know about crime and education, walkability, the number of restaurants, and obviously they want to know about the housing structure, the cost per square inch, all the neighborhood as well as structural characteristics. And so we wanted to compare those homes, similar homes in white and black neighborhoods. So we looked at those with a proportion of the population of greater than 50% black and those with less than 1% black. And what we found is startling. We did an apples to apples comparison, and homes in majority black neighborhoods are worth 23% less, which accounts for $48,000 per home.
And when you talk about this issue, you cannot escape the history. And the study refers to our country's history of not just the enslaving Africans to, you know, all the way to the Jim Crow laws, to racist housing policies like redlining. But how did history play a role in what we're seeing today? How you had it in your research?
Yes, history matters. And so the when we did not invest because of redlining, because blacks could not move into better neighborhoods because of racial covenants, because of racist practices in lending and a number of other areas, we do know that homes in majority black neighborhoods are worth less. It does impact the quality of schooling. We know that years of discrimination in terms of housing discrimination, it impacts the quality of school. So all of these things have an impact. It's just that when you control for, when you look at similar situated homes in similar situated neighborhoods, they're still worth less, even more. They're worth less than you would expect. And so, yes, history matters, and it matters mightily. Homes in majority black neighborhoods are worth 50% less before you control for a lot of these characteristics.
How did you?
And so, but go ahead.
Well, I want to come back to, because you started touching on how you were fine that oranges to oranges, because you wanted to make sure that the comparison was equal. But what were the characteristics you were looking for in how you were able to come up with that those values?
So, in essence, you want to look at structural characteristics. So, the year the home was built, the square footage, the number of bedrooms, and we also looked at census and Zillow data. And then you want to look at neighborhood amenities, like the economic, demographic, and physical landscape of the neighborhood. We want to look at public education and walkability and access to jobs by measured by commute times and the number of retail shops. So we essentially say, okay, let's find homes that are similar. Let's do an apples-to-apples comparison. And after we found those homes in each metro, we saw that the lesser value after accounting for all those things.
And you mentioned walkability and public transportation, and you found in the study that sometimes those things do add some value to a home, but you found that not always reflected in home values in black communities.
Yeah, you know, we tend to think of black community, I mean, you heard this during the presidential election. President Trump said in his plea to the black community, he said, what do you have to lose? But in black communities, walkability scores are up. Access to public transportation, it's a good thing. There's reasons why many people seek housing in black communities, because they do have a lot of amenities. But they also struggle from a lack of investment over time because of some of the policies that were mentioned, the redlining, the racial covenants of the past. And so there's a lot to be to for folks to learn. I encourage everybody just to go to the brookings.edu site and look for the devaluation of assets in black neighborhoods report, because they can even scroll and look across the country. And in Miami, in South Florida in particular, the house price differences between white and black neighborhoods.
We're talking with Andre Perry. He's a fellow with the Brookings Institute, a nonprofit public policy organization based in Washington, D.C. Perry is behind a new report from Brookings that he's been talking about that's examined the devaluation of homes in majority African-American neighborhoods across the country. What about South Florida, you know, stood out to you, though?
Yeah, you know, it generally followed national averages, 20% less particularly in Miami, Fort Lauderdale, West Palm Beach area. There's essentially a 41,000 price difference on average between homes in black neighborhoods versus homes in white neighborhoods. It's a very diverse place. So when you're talking about black, you're really encompassing the number of ethnicities in that category. There are places in Florida where you saw a great deal of appreciation, where homes in black neighborhoods were worth more. The Sebastian Vero Beach, for instance, area, and Ocala, Florida, for instance, that homes are worth more in black neighborhoods. But for the most part, in metro areas, blacks, homes in black neighborhoods are worth less. But in general, they follow national averages.
And real quickly, too, is that, you know, a lot of the times I think you find that black homeowners don't know this. They don't know that they're being undervalued. And so if they're selling, they could be asking for more. There was actually, you have an example of a play that actually points out to, you know, how, look, you've got to be able to know your value to ask for that value.
Yeah, my favorite play in all the world is Two Trains Running by the great August Wilson. And in the play, the main character, Memphis, is going to have his restaurant seized through eminent domain by the city of Pittsburgh. And the main character, Memphis, says, no, I won't sell it for what they asked for, $15,000. I won't sell it. I know my price. There is another character, Hambone, who painted a fence for a proprietor. And he painted the fence for a ham. He never got his ham. And he demanded throughout the play for years for his ham that he never received. And he actually went crazy and died at the end of the play. But the play actually has a happy ending, because after going back and forth with the city eventually gave the main character $30,000, more than what he demanded. And the moral of the story is that you better know your worth. You have to know your value. What this report does, it gives people a sense of what they should be asking for when they're selling, buying. But more importantly, it's about making a statement of you're worth more than what you're priced. And so I really want communities to take this information and become empowered by it. They can animate their communities. They can take risk in their communities, because their homes are worth more than what they are priced.
And so, you know, basically is that, you know, I wondered if you've heard from policymakers or from community advocates or homeowners about these findings, and, you know, how they might be able to take that information and do something with it.
Yes, certainly we have to get at federal policy around lending, biased lending practices, biased real estate agent practices, and appraisal practices that certainly skew negatively towards Black communities. But this is also about folks demanding their value. You're not going to see a change in the market if folks just stand pat and just say, hey, there's nothing we can do. Folks have to take this information at a personal level, animate your communities to say, hey, we should be investing with a coffee shop. We should be investing in our own homes more. We should do that. But it's also about demanding more from federal policy to make sure that folks are getting their fair share. We do know that the appraisal process is rife with subjectivity. And so in that subjectivity, it disfavors Black community. And so we should be doing much more in that arena and working with federal agencies to do that. But this is also about having a community conversation about value. Just because Black people are in a place does not necessarily mean the houses should be worth less. And more importantly, and what I want to do with this study is to make sure that we stop with this rhetoric that Black folk aren't doing enough to pick up their own communities. The 40 something thousand dollars in Miami that should go to a kid's tuition, that should go towards starting a new business, to fixing up your home, to moving to a better neighborhood, is being robbed because of racism. These are the dollars people use to uplift themselves, and we're taking that money away from them. And this gets to the core of our American dream. We have people who are doing everything asked of them to get a piece of that American dream, and we are denying them simply because we see Black neighborhoods or Black people as reducing the value of property, and that's just insane.
Andre Perry, again, fellow with the Brookings Institute, a nonprofit public policy organization based in Washington, D.C., and he is the author of a new report from Brookings that examined the devaluation of homes in majority Black neighborhoods across the country. Again, majority Black neighborhoods, the homes in those neighborhoods are almost 41,000 or more less in average than a home in a majority white neighborhood that's comparable in construction and all the other amenities. And again, a reminder, you can find that information too online. We'll have it posted up on our social media. Mr. Perry, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for sharing.
Again, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you as well. Stick around, by the way, for the end of the program. We're going to announce the January title for the Sundial Book Club. Well, still to come, the Broadway hit Hamilton is playing in South Florida, and that has sparked a conversation about hip-hop in South Florida. More on that coming up next on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. For those of you who grew up down here in South Florida, you remember Two Live Crew. You recognize the sound. That was part of the soundtrack of my teenage years. That is a little bit of Two Live Crew, one of the iconic South Florida rap groups that helped shape a unique sound that came from Miami. Today on Sundial, we're going to talk about some of that music with three artists who grew up here. They're going to be at Nova Southeastern University for a symposium tomorrow talking about musical history beginning at 6 o'clock. It's free and open to the public, and there will also be a drop-in dance course from 4 to 6. And if I wasn't a little bit sick, I might actually try that. By the way, this conversation comes as Hamilton, the Broadway hit, is at the Broward Center for a limited run over the next few weeks. So what Miami-based rap song or artist best depicts that Miami sound? You know, find us on Facebook or on Twitter and post and share your pick with us. We'd love to know. Well, joining me now in studio, and this is part of the panel in the symposium coming up tomorrow, Luis Gisbert. He's a photographer and artist with work that focuses on hip-hop and youth culture and Cuban-American history. Luis, it's such a pleasure, man. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Also joining me is Candy Lopez, also an artist whose work represents individuals within the urban community and using hip-hop as inspiration, also swagger. And I love that idea. Candy, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
And William Cordova is joining us as well. He's going to be part of the symposium, and he's a cultural practitioner. William, it's such a pleasure, man. Thanks so much.
Hola, Sacpase. Hello.
All right. So real quickly, all of you, I wanted to get a sense of, for this symposium, what you're going to be talking about, the history of rap music that's coming out of Miami, that's been coming out of Miami for decades now. But what is it exactly in this conversation that you want to share with people? What is it that you want people to either reminisce or think about? William, let me start with you.
I'm always thinking about the synthesis of music in general. And the intersections of South Florida, the Caribbean, Central South America, Mexico, even Europe, and of course North America, the North, not necessarily Florida. And so a lot of these intersections are very interesting to talk about because we can categorize them or talk about them all as one, especially in South Florida, because sometimes when people speak, they'll speak in Creole, English, Spanish at the same time, and all within one sentence. And I think that's something very unique to South Florida. And it's something that has influenced my practice as a visual practitioner and as well as my peers.
And you know what, let me just, because I want to know also from all of you is because you spent a lot of time, you grew up or you spent a lot of time in South Florida, but for you, the music that came out of South Florida, how did it impact your life?
I think as a child, we don't necessarily define it. Later on, when we leave, I left the state back in 1985 for about 4 months when I was 14 years old. And I realized how much the scene in South Florida was impacting the rest of the country. Not only Miami Vice visual culture,
yeah,
but sonically through a lot of DJ culture. You played Two Live Crew, I think, early on.
Yeah.
And I think that that's an example of really early on. But in 85, Two Live Crew was still in California.
Yeah.
And it wasn't what it became later in 86. And so for me, it was more DJ music, sampling, cassette tapes from flea markets, Avenue Flea Market, things like that, that I came back to and started really listening to more because being in Houston really gave me a perspective.
Yeah. Luis, how about you? Tell me a little bit about, your growing up here in South Florida and kind of how what were you listening to, by the way?
Well, see, so ever, if anyone remembers Rhythm 98, which was that station that between 85 to 88 they would play specifically Miami bass freestyle music. So that was the soundtrack that was playing when I was in elementary school. But the one of the discussions I think that's going around this symposium is this phenomenon of what was hip-hop, Miami hip-hop music, and how it was inspiring a generation, how it inspired me, because this is the music that you listen to when you're in elementary school, junior high, high school. And then the music, for at least for my art, it was what inspired me before I knew what art was. When I went away, mm-hmm. I left Miami, went to art school, start to look back at your biography. But that specific sound of Miami that was very unique, I didn't know that at the time. And that's the only music I knew because I grew up in Little Havana.
Because you grew up in it, you don't think about it. It's exactly. Until you leave.
Exactly.
And so then when you left, how did it hit you? What did you think about what you were, what you had grown up with?
Well, it's funny because I don't really discover rock and roll music till I go to college. So all through high school, it was just hip hop music pretty much straight across. And of course, you get to classic rock and WC and all that. But
right.
But it wasn't until you leave that you start to see this other world. Like, I didn't know what the White Album was when I was in college.
That's all right. I got introduced to a lot of things at college as well. Candy, what about you? What your experience growing up and because I want to get a sense of what your approach is going to be during this discussion. But what our approach is today in this talk. What should we be discussing besides just reminiscing?
Well, for the talk that we're having tomorrow for the symposium, we're also incorporating art history within the talk within hip hop. So having this culmination of art and how art has influenced hip hop and how hip hop has also influenced art. So I was born in Jersey. I moved down to Miami and I landed in Hialeah. And it was Bayonne, New Jersey, right? So this is the 80s. And by the time I got to Hialeah, it was the 90s and everything was about hip hop and Spanish music.
What were you listening to?
There was a lot of Trina and Trick Daddy. Mm-hmm. There was Two Life Crew still on the radio. There was also DJ Laz, which was, the hot
big deal.
Yep.
The big deal back then. So you have that song, Ese Morena, que buena esta, right? So that's something that I grew up listening to, but I didn't realize that it affected me and my artwork until I decided to get my master's degree at FAU. And then I realized, a lot of the things that had to deal with middle school and all the music that I've heard within middle school really impacted the way that I create my work. Like when I'm creating, that's what I have on is hip hop.
Something interesting, and Luis had said it. So, because I'm also thinking about what era you guys were growing up here in South Florida. But this goes back, and Luis, you had mentioned, for example, and William, you also said as well, it's like this is we go back to those days when everything was on cassette and a lot of how we shared music was cassette. Obviously there was no internet, so there was no YouTube, but it was just like you made a tape.
You recorded off the radio.
You record off the radio and you shared that tape with other people. And Luis, because you had relatives up in New York, right? And so you have that sound that's coming out of New York, New Jersey. Where you guys were sharing music like, hey, but here's what's coming out of Miami.
Exactly. Like, I have cousins that were in Jersey City, and I would get the dose of the New York hip-hop, the Tommy Boy stuff, that was maybe slower to get to Miami through that. So there was definitely, but also the freestyle music, which was being produced in Miami and New Jersey, and it was back and forth. But yes, it was a tape.
And you know what? Going back to that, I love that. I missed those things, the little cassettes. But what were they saying about what was coming out of Miami, the stuff that you were sending them? Why are you laughing?
Yeah, because that's the thing, the difference, because that was the big thing once you left Miami or got that sense of music, that Miami hip hop, it was very braggadocio, very explicit, very sexual, very humorous. And there wasn't any conscious hip hop coming out. So it wasn't until you heard Public Enemy or something coming out of, New York that you started to realize, wait, there's another side to hip hop. So Miami music was always known as the party music. Mm-hmm. It was loud bass and funny lyrics.
And William, I loved how you brought up too, because you mentioned Miami Vice, and what it made me think about is how visual. It's not just the sound that was coming out of Miami, but also, with hip hop, with music in general, there is a visual aspect. And, what was coming out of Miami is there was this unique color vibrancy and a lot of neon. But I mean, how would you describe what people were seeing, not just hearing, but seeing that was coming out of Miami, especially back going back into the 80s?
Well, in 85, when I went to Houston, people were still breakdancing, and that had already faded away about a year and a half before in Miami. So I thought they were way behind. And when I came back, I started just listening to a lot more DJ music, but I also heard back from people from New York, and this is before Lewis's time, which is in 85, 86, 87, people were not taking Southern hip hop very seriously. It was pretty much dismissed in the North and the West Coast up until the late 80s when it started really getting more national. A lot of the acts started getting more national, so they started paying more attention. And eventually, a lot of people from South Florida moved north, first to Orlando, Cheetah Records, and then off to Georgia, and that evolved into...
And you talk about Southern hip-hop. I mean, because people like thinking of like the East Coast, West Coast, but there was a Southern hip-hop, and there was a number of Southern cities, like New Orleans, Atlanta, Miami, that were part of that network and creating a very different sound.
Even in Tampa, of course, Orlando and Jacksonville, it slowly started moving up north, and I think Miami took the back seat eventually. And that kind of faded away, like the Southern, the booty bass type of sound, because that's how you defined the South Florida rap, not hip-hop, because it wasn't hip-hop yet.
Right.
It was rap then, which is the two Bs and the V, which is the bass, booty, and velocity.
Yeah.
And that's how you differ rap music in South Florida then, especially in the mid-'80s to late 80s, from any other state or any other city in the U.S.
Yeah. Again, we're talking about some of the history of Miami bass, the Miami bass sound, Miami rap, the evolution of hip hop in South Florida. It's the focus of a symposium that's coming to Nova Southeastern University. It's tomorrow at 6 p.m. It's free and open to the public. There will be a drop-in dance course from 4 to 6. The three panelists hosting this conversation are the artist and photographer Luis Gisbert. He is here in studio. Also joining me is Candy Lopez, artist Candy Lopez, and cultural practitioner William Cordova. And we're listening now to a little bit of DJ Magic Mike, one of those key...
No. That's Vicious Bass.
It's Vicious Bass. It's featuring DJ Magic Mike. My apologies.
Yeah, MC Madness.
This is, Vicious Bass from All Wild DJs. He Will Tame, featuring DJ Magic Mike. Thank you for clearing that up for me. This is some of that sound coming in the 90s as well. All right, so you know, one of the beautiful aspects I think of rap music, especially that early rapper, maybe it's just me, but again, this is the older guy talking here, is that it was telling this fascinating story about life in these neighborhoods, in these communities, mostly black communities, this daily struggle, the street violence, police brutality. I'm curious, when you guys were growing up, what was the draw? And I know South Florida hip hop telling a little bit of a different story, but I wonder, what was the draw for you? Why was whether it was South Florida hip hop or any hip hop, why were you so attracted to it? Candy, let me start with you.
I think it was the connection within the story, like the story of, or the message behind some of the songs. It also related to art as well. So you have this message of survival. So when it comes to the inner city within music, it was a way to politically and socially go the opposite direction of what people were listening to on the radio, or like understood the stories of the young kids that were growing up within this neighborhood. So it was trying to create this message so that they know, hey, there's another way out, or hey, I can relate to what it is that you're going through, at least through the music. And when it comes to the message of survival within art history, survival of, you know, I'm talking back within the Renaissance. So they had, you know, those really big glamorous dresses, and it was always depicting the majority, which were white people.
Right.
So it was a way of showing their survival after they have passed. When we're talking about the message of survival within music, is showing the message of survival within their life, how to live through what it is that they were going through.
I was always curious too about, because and I grew up, I mean, growing up in West Palm Beach, so I grew up in the Wellington community, and this is a predominantly white community. And so not a lot of Hispanics like me and very few black students at the school. But rap, hip-hop, and especially what was coming out of Miami, was really, really popular. And I wondered, you know, what was the connection that we had with the music? We didn't have those issues of survivability as much.
I think it was a way to go also against your parents and what your parents' generation and their music
yes,
was.
Yes, that's true.
So it was a way of rebelling and also telling that story.
Right. Yeah. No, that's a very good point. Luis, what about you? What do you think about that?
Well, for me, that was the landscape. That was all you could hear, because I grew up in Little Havana and went to public school, so white kids were the minority. So it was right. Latino and then blacks, and that was the music that was there, and it was the radio, and so there was a direct connection of but it, like we were talking earlier about when we were talking about the bass and the electro beat, where I was forgot to mention, like, Baltimore also had a parallel scene that had, so Miami had a big connection to the electro scene that was going on in New York and in Baltimore with that very basic minimal beat and high cymbal, which in a way it's kind of proto trap, because like rap now has become gone back to being very minimal again, not overly produced, as these early records were also very minimally produced.
You know, William, real quickly too, is, and you had brought it up at the very beginning, is you know, what's unique about South Florida is the fact that, I mean, this is I don't like saying the word diversity, but this is you've got this mesh of people from all over Latin America and the Caribbean, and they're bringing their influence. And so is there one thing that you would say that really did bring that pushed and created a greater influence on rap music, you know, whether it's Caribbean or some other kind of beat that's coming from another part of the world?
Well, before I answer that, I want to tell you, you don't like the word diversity?
No.
In relation to this conversation?
It's overused. I think it's overused. And it's like, we get it. Miami, South Florida is so diverse. We get it.
Oh, I see.
That's what I meant by that.
Yeah. No, I don't agree with that. I don't think it's diverse at all. I think it's extremely segregated. But what I'm talking about is certain intersections that certain communities meet at. It doesn't mean that it's diverse. There's certain commonalities, like even if you talk about the music like Boogaloo, that's a coming together of different cultures and races and different genres of music. Salsa, the same. Of course, rock music and how it's evolved. Rap music, when it evolved, it was not only coming from the black community, but it was also coming from the brown community, the Anglo community. It's just that it's very unique to South Florida, that experience. The closest you get to it is maybe New York, but it's not necessarily talked about and not historicized.
I think that, yeah. And you know what? And I wasn't clear, because I think that the way I was thinking of it was, you know, you think even going back into the 70s and beyond is, you know, what that Caribbean influence especially was, Cuban, Puerto Rican, that was, you know, predominant here in South Florida, and how that may have, you know, helped influence. Like, all music is influenced by something before.
Yeah.
And so I think that's what I was coming at.
I mean, like, the first rap to come out of Miami was from 1979, which is Xanadu and Sweet Lady, which did Rocker's Choice. And a lot of people don't know about that. And it was two Jamaican singers, and it was released by Joe Gibbs' record company in Opalaka.
No, good point. That's exactly what I wanted to get at. Again, talking about the history of rap here in South Florida, because again, there's a symposium that's coming up, and I want to mention again, it is free and open to the public. It's at Nova Southeastern University. It starts at 6 o'clock tomorrow, and so everybody is welcome to go. And by the way, they do have a drop-in dance course from 4 to 6, so if that's something that, you know, you're interested in, please check it out. We'll have more information, by the way, on our Facebook and on Twitter. Find us at WLRN Sundial. Real quickly, Candy, you were talking about how this music influenced your work as an artist. How so? And I know, I mean, we could talk about different projects. I know I was looking at one of yours, for example, the Miami Project. I thought was fascinating. But, I mean, for you growing up, how did it? How does it play a role daily in your work?
I think it has to do a lot with the culture of hip-hop. I am a portrait painter, and I dabble a little bit in within the environment of where these people are from. I think it's important to showcase that environment within places that a lot of majority people go to, because they don't see the real South Florida. They see South Beach. They see where the money is. They see the tourists. They see Brickell. They don't see Little Havana or Little Haiti or Carroll City or Opa-locka. That's a place where you don't go or you, you know, lock your doors when you're driving by. So it's important for me to showcase these kinds of individuals within my work. And I think a lot of it also has to deal with fashion. This swagger is what I like to use within my work.
Yep.
Because I think it's important for these people. It's a way for them to show their individuality within what it is that they're wearing and also show that they're not invisible. So the flashier you are, the more swag you have, this vulnerable strength that you're putting off, which is a facade. It's just a mask that you wear.
Yeah.
Just like we're wearing masks right now to be on radio. Just like we wear masks to be a professor, right?
You know, one of the things though I loved looking back on, especially the Miami Project, was there was a grittiness to it. And I think that's just how I connected to that early hip hop that I remember growing up with in the late 80s. And it was just, even the album covers, there was a grittiness to it. Because it was dealing with something that was right. It was supposed to be real. This isn't, let's not sugarcoat it. Here's the hardcore stuff. Luis, for you, real quickly, what, you know, how does it influence your work? I love, for example, I mean, some of the videos that I've seen, the going back to the turntables, I love the big boom boxes. Right. You love using that image.
Right. Well, it's interesting that we look back at the early days of hip hop and Miami hip hop, that it was an analog. We talked about cassettes, turntables, records, boom boxes. There was a lot of gear. So that translated for me very easily when I started to make sculpture. So being inspired, most visual artists are inspired by music or the music they grew up with or what they listen to currently. So it was inevitable that I was going to be influenced by that music that made a big impact on me. But that the using, then when you go to, you know, connecting it to art history and how do you connect turntables and speakers. And William is also an artist who has been interested in that.
You also have, William, you have a display that I've seen also, you know, it's that connection to the sound itself. And again, going back to the big woofers and the big speakers, I love those images. A lot of memories for me.
You're talking about Machu Picchu After Dark?
I think sculpture. That's, is that the one of the, yes.
Yes. Yes, it's a silent drum type of sculpture which relates Andean architecture and Afro-Peruvian culture from Peru.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, the synthesis. And the experience that me as a child saw in South Florida when I first arrived, and I mistakenly took disposed of old wooden speakers for Afro-Peruvian cajon, which is Afro-Peruvian drum. Excuse me. Later on, as an adult, I spent a year collecting them, and eventually created. I'm talking about disposed of speakers. Created a large tower as a nod to both the synthesis of Afro and Andean cultures, which is from my background and part of Peru. And so that became Machu Picchu After Dark piece. Yeah.
Again, talking with artist and photographer Luis Gasper, artist Candy Lopez, and cultural practitioner William Cordova. They're part of the panel at the symposium tomorrow at Nova Southeastern University. It starts at 6, again, free and open to the public. And we'd love to hear from you, your thoughts. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Let us know. You grew up here in South Florida. What was that Miami rap scene? What was that bass sound that influenced your youth? Share with us. Tell us about your favorite sound, your favorite music. Folks, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for
reminiscing. I had a lot of time. Part of my youth. I loved it. All right, still to come, we're going to talk about the upcoming South Beach Jazz Festival, a program put together to bring awareness to those who are dealing with disabilities and illnesses. That's coming up next. What you didn't know is when you slow your blow, didn't have nothing on me, had to let me go. But as I slow roll through the neighborhood, I glance at your car, police of Hollywood. Someday somebody's going to stop you, Broward County cop. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Miami Beach native David New believes there's something about music that transcends illness and pain. He started the South Beach Jazz Festival 3 years ago because he wanted to raise awareness surrounding those with disabilities and illnesses. New became blind in 2000 after suffering from a rare illness caused by AIDS. He's put together the festival with all musicians that either have a disability or an illness or are directly connected to someone who has one. Now, the festival kicks off Thursday at Miami Beach with a series of free shows and paid performances that end January 6th. David New joins us now to talk about why he started the festival and, you know, what you can expect. David, it's such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And also joining us is one of the performers, a drummer, Jonathan Joseph, who will be performing with the Weather Underground. Joseph was diagnosed with a prostate cancer back in 2016 and is sharing his story and using music to help people again find a way to get past that fear of having that conversation. Joseph, thanks so much, man. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
All right, David, real quickly, what inspired you to launch the jazz festival at Miami Beach?
Well, I am a resident of Miami Beach, and it was something that I envisioned for a long time. I am very much involved in the community and wanted there to be a way to bring people together. I wanted there to be a palpable feeling throughout the community of togetherness, and the best way to do it, I thought, was through music.
You know, it's a conversation, you know, you think about when people talk about disabilities or they talk about their illness, it's very difficult to have that conversation for a lot of folks, and you want to help them and do that through music and through these shows. You want them to be comfortable in having those conversations, right?
For sure. Most people are awkward in situations when it comes to disability, especially physical ones that are very obvious that you can see. Of course, most disabilities you can't see, but we are, you know, bringing that to the table, you know, during this event. We're actually encouraging the musicians with the disabilities to speak about them and to speak about their experience, because we are just like you. We're all the same. Just because I can't see my hand in front of my face doesn't mean that I don't have the same feelings and the similar experiences and, you know, put my pants on one leg at a time.
Jonathan Joseph, I was curious. Yes. Why did you want to take part in the Jazz Fest?
Well, I was born on Miami Beach, and I think that this is a wonderful opportunity for me to reflect on my own musical history, and that the Weather Underground band presents the music of the band Weather Report and also of Jaco Pistorius. And of course, as many of you know, Jaco, you know, grew up in Fort Lauderdale and is credited with changing the sound of the electric bass. And the music that he created and the influence that he had has been significant throughout the world, and he's influenced so many people. So I had the opportunity to work with Joe Zivinal, the leader of Weather Report, back in the mid-90s. And it's always been in my mind to have a project that plays and performs this music, because Joe is no longer with us. Neither is Jaco. So being from Miami, having an opportunity, you know, with the South Beach Jazz Festival, it all just kind of lines up and makes sense.
You know, you it's interesting. You spoke with our host, Tracy Letts, about your illness, about the prostate cancer.
Right.
Tell us about when you were first diagnosed.
That was in February of 16. I actually went in for shingles. I had like a mild case of the shingles and did a blood test and came back with an extremely high PSA reading. Which I was kind of like shocked and devastated. Ended up going in for a biopsy shortly after that.
Why did you want to share your story?
Why? Because this prostate cancer is something that is not discussed amongst men, as you know. You know, when we're sitting around watching the game or whatever, you know, at the bar, this topic is never brought up. You know, so I thought now that I'm kind of like on the downside of my situation, in that I've had surgery, I've recovered, I'm back, you know, to my normal function.
Do you find that, you know, talking about it now, men are approaching you and they're like, oh, thank you, because I didn't know how to even start this conversation.
No, because this is really the first time that I've ever really discussed it publicly.
Okay.
You know, when I was diagnosed, I just did not want people coming to me, you know, wishing me well and,
right.
you know, offering sympathy. And, you know, that might be a bit weird, but that just, it's not who I am.
There's always that, and you know what, I'm curious, David, too, is there's always that moment of discomfort in people if they notice that someone does have a disability, if it's obvious, that they're trying to get around it and not talk about it. But I wondered how you've felt with people, and did you have to bring it up, or do you find a way to get them to feel comfortable? Like, it's okay, you could talk to me, and it's not, you know.
Well, it's a matter of education, really. People, you know, in any situation, like shopping in a department store or a supermarket, you know, when I ask for assistance, people will speak to the person that's next to me and not me, not expecting me to be able to speak for myself. So I have to, you know, be my own advocate and speak up and say, look, you know, I can hear you and I can make my own decisions. And, you know, I want the Roma tomatoes, not the beefsteak ones.
That's a good point. I like that. Again, I'm talking with Miami Beach native David New. He is the founder of South Beach's Jazz Festival, which was started 3 years ago, and it's there to raise awareness surrounding those with disabilities and illnesses. And of course, it's also there for some really good music. Also joining us is local drummer Jonathan Joseph, who will be performing at the Jazz Festival with the Weather Underground. You know what? I wanted to get a sense, David, what's the jazz scene like right now in Miami Beach? And actually, you know, Jonathan, I want to hear from you as well on that.
Well, I think personally, it's been lacking for several years. There was a jazz scene, and I think it's just absent now. And that's one of the reasons why I wanted to bring this to the beach, because it really, I think there's a large group of people that really want it there. And that was part of my decision in bringing it.
Jonathan, it's lacking. Is it lacking?
It definitely is.
How did that happen?
Well, I'm not. That's a good question. I guess kind of like developers came in and moved everybody out. But back in the late '80s, I think there was a thriving jazz scene. I think on just really in South Florida and in Miami, as well as.